From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Bloch. Now, we've turned off the lights here in the studio. I'm holding a book in my hand, and it's glowing in the dark, a ghostly light green. The book is titled Radioactive. It's a stunning visual biography of Pierre and Marie Curie, describing through image and text their discoveries of radium and polonium and describing their passionate marriage. The author and artist Lauren Redness calls it a tale of love and fallout. And Lauren Redness, you met the Curie's granddaughter in Paris when you were working on this book. She gave you a kind of a warning. What did she tell you?
She warned me about two things. She said that the first danger in writing about the Curies is to turn their story into a fairy tale. And the second danger is to forget Pierre. So while I very deliberately did fall into the first trap and emphasized in some ways the fairy tale aspects of their story, I tried to highlight Pierre's work.
Well, let's talk about that first trap that you deliberately or willfully blundered into, you said in this book. Marie Curie is a young scientist from Poland. She comes to Paris. She meets Pierre Curie, and they become inseparable. And that, to you, you heightened the romantic parts of this. They bicycle on their honeymoon.
Yes, it was really important to me to not separate the human element from the scientific developments.
Did it strike you right away that the Curie story was a visual one, that's something you, as an artist, wanted to tell, not just in words, but in pictures?
It presented a really interesting challenge because it's largely about invisible forces. It's about love. It's about radioactivity, these things that we can't see. And so to make a visual book about that was an intriguing challenge for me.
Let's talk about that challenge and how you solved it, because the images in this book are sort of luminous. They're vibrating with color. What did you do?
Most of the images in the book are made with a process called cyanotype printing, and it is a process based on the idea of exposure. So that made thematic sense to me. What you do is you take paper and you coat it with a light-sensitive chemical solution. You place on that, in my case, a negative of my drawings, and then you expose it to sunlight. The UV rays of the sunlight interact with the chemical and turn the paper blue.
And a lot of the images in the book are blue. They're not glowing, but they sort of look like they're lifting off the page a little bit.
Right. That blue has sort of a twilight quality. And because you're getting a negative of the drawings, they often have a white line. And that, to me, had this certain kind of glow that reflected what Marie Curie called radium spontaneous luminosity.
Mm. You have a section here where you talk about Marie Curie keeping a vial, a tube of radium, right next to her pillow. Pierre Curie strapping some onto his arm and watching a lesion develop on his arm. But he's not horrified by it. He's fascinated. He's delighted for some reason. Why?
I think they saw these effects with a scientific detachment. And they, as you describe, when Pierre put that vial of radium against his arm and saw the lesion develop, they understood that if radium could destroy healthy tissue, it may also be able to destroy diseased tissue, and they began to develop cancer treatments.
You describe what happens after the Curies discover radium. It becomes an instant commercial hit. People think it's a wonder drug, and you have a long list of products that were marketed around radium. What were some of them?
There was toothpaste, there were pillows, there was chocolates, all kinds of medicines and household products and just about anything you could imagine to give your body and mind a healthy glow.
Were these things that were actually put on the market with radium, or were these just ideas?
Some were and some weren't. In some cases, there was radium in the products, and in other cases, it was more along the lines of something like an American Express gold card, where, you know, there isn't actually gold in that card, but radium was used as a branding selling point.
Yeah, what was the thinking? That because it was glowing, that it would be some sort of life force?
Yeah, it was a sort of panacea. It was promised to impart longevity. It was promised to impart virility, general, all-over health.
Mm. And the idea, there was one other idea, which is fascinating, too, that you could paint your walls with radium paint, and the whole room would be sort of lighted from within. You imagine what that would look like with one of your illustrations, which is sort of has this greenish turquoise glow. The whole room is glowing with this paint.
Yes, there was a chemist who formulated a radium paint that he called undark paint. And he said, you know, if you were to paint your house with this paint, it would be as if there was moonlight.
Do you ever think about what that would be like to have a room that looked like that?
Oh, I think it would be heavenly.
You do?
I think that that is part of the quality that I try to capture in that image that you describe and in the cyanotypes, that this kind of twilight softness.
If it weren't for the radium, it would all be great, right?
Right, exactly. If it wasn't toxic, you can't feed it.
Well, Lauren Redness, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lauren Redness is the author and artist behind the visual biography Radioactive, Marie and Pierre Curie, A Tale of Love and Fallout. You can see a slideshow of images from the book at npr.org.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Perhaps for the holidays you get some high-tech clothing, a jacket where your iPhone fits, maybe gloves built in with those speaker microphones. But what if the clothes were the devices themselves, like your polo shirt doubling as a battery pack, each thread a tiny, flexible lithium battery? Well, my next guest may have figured out one of the secrets to get us closer to these futuristic fabrics, a way to take all kinds of material, I mean, batteries, solar cell superconductors, and twist them into tiny yarns that could be woven into fabric. That work appears this week in the journal Science. Ray Bachman is director of the Nanotech Institute at the University of Texas at Dallas and professor of chemistry there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you. It's a great honor to be on NPR. I listen to it all the time.
Thank you very much. Tell us about these fibers and how you make them and what you put in them.
Okay. Ordinary yarns are functional. Since prehistoric times, humankind has used yarns to make textiles that provide protection and beauty. Now, as we want to make textiles from yarns that are multifunctional, and what we put into the yarns determines this extra function, whether it be energy harvesting, energy storage, or energy conversion, or even superconductivity.
So you make the yarns functional by what's inside the yarn.
Uh-huh. And powders are especially important for providing functionality. A challenge in the past is how do you take powders and make them into yarns that are mostly powder without destroying the ability to knit, sew, weave, and braid the yarn. This is the type of problem we solved.
And tell us what kinds of things you could make. I mean, what are the powders made of that you twist into these yarns?
For example, to make superconducting yarns, we use a mixture of magnesium and boron in order to make the superconductor. The fundamental approach, however, is that we take webs of carbon nanotubes. These are little cylinders of carbon. These webs are an unusual state of matter in the sense that they can be lighter than air, but still stronger than on a per weight basis than steel. Mm-hmm. We take these carbon nanotube webs and overlay them with powders of the guest material so that we make a yarn eventually that is 95% or even more of powder.
So the yarn just gives it a shape.
The yarn gives strength,
right?
because of the extremely high mechanical properties of the individual carbon nanotubes. They're able to a few percent of these carbon nanotubes is able to hold together this vastly larger amount of powder.
So if the powder is made up, let's say, of battery material, and you put it into the yarn now just becomes a big battery.
It becomes a battery electrode, and we can make take another yarn, which is the opposite electrode, and twist those two yarns together with a electronically insulating material in between, and we get a battery.
So your shirt could be a battery.
Even more than that, the individual fibers in your shirt can be individual batteries.
You don't want to get wet.
That's not really a problem because these batteries, the yarns, will be overcoated in such a way that you can't get short.
Yeah, but you know, thinking of clothing, but you could make furniture, for example, or car seats and things that could store electricity in them.
You're right on the mark. We can, for example, in automobiles. There's a major effort from a viewpoint of saving energy to make the cars lighter. But on the other hand, people want to have electrical vehicles where you harvest the energy from braking and to power the car at later times. So you want to have a battery or supercapacitor in the car. But batteries and supercapacitors add a lot of weight. If you want to minimize the amount of weight that results from, you can just make, weave these special yarns into a fabric which is placed in the panel of the automobile, which provides strength for the automobile, but also provides the ability to store electricity.
Could you make the car itself, the body, out of, you know, carbons? Maybe you have carbon bodies, right? Couldn't you just weave it out of a carbon fabric and store the electricity right in the fender or something?
You're absolutely right. Thinking in a lot of our work, most of our work in this new technology was supported by the Air Force. The Air Force is interested in having air vehicles and micro air vehicles that are light, that have longer range. And there, that we're talking about having the whole framework of the aircraft made out of these special multifunctional yarns that provide strength, plus also functions, even the ability, for example, on a micro-air vehicle to morph the wing.
What about storing hydrogen, for example?
That's a good point. Question also. Major problem with conventional hydrogen storage material is that they're powders that break apart when you cycle hydrogen in and out. And there's no real way to get hydrogen in and out of a container of a powder because you have to diffuse through large distances. But if we incorporate our powders for our yarns into the particular geometries that we use, you hold the particles in place so that when we break apart, that doesn't matter, and you can provide a woven vascular system of the yarns that allows easy entrance of the hydrogen and exit of the hydrogen. These powders in our multifunctional yarns are held together in the corridors of scrolls. Think of your bath, rubberized bathroom mat for the shower. If you twist this mat into a rod by twisting from one side, you get what's called an Archimedean scroll. If you twist another way, you get more complex scrolls. But in each case, the scroll enables the powder to be trapped, so much trapped that we can take our multifunctional textile yarns and weave them into textiles, wash them vigorously, and we see no change in their properties.
Wow. Let me get a quick question from Alicia in Mesa, Arizona. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if these fibers can be used to heat and cool our bodies and indoor environments, and I'm also wondering about therapeutic applications. I'm a nurse. I'm wondering about keeping neonates' bodies at a particular temperature after birth and keeping people cool during surgical procedures and that sort of thing.
Wow.
Oh, very good question. Because the yarns are electrically conducting, we could heat textiles electrically. But you could do this with a ordinary metal wire. More interestingly is we can use multifunctionality to be able to change the porosity of a textile. And that enables heat. for example, for a soldier who's in a hot environment or exercising, that heat and perspiration to evaporate. On the other hand, if he's in a cold, or he or she is in a cold environment, you can close the pore structure of the textile.
Wow.
For medical applications, we're collaborating with people in Korea, in Hanyang University, who are working with us to, under a Air Force program, to make yarns that can convert sugars in the body into electrical electricity, which could be very important for powering sensors that are in with the body, and ultimately, hopefully, even powering a artificial heart.
Amazing. I'm saying too many wows this segment. Now, how practical, how close are we? And as I say before, and as you said before, these things are washable, right? They will not lose their abilities if you throw them in the laundry.
No, they are very easily washable. For example, we put titanium dioxide, a metal oxide that is can be used to make self-cleaning fibers. We put this within our yarns, within the scrolls of our yarn, in order to make self-cleaning textiles.
Well, and how soon do you think any of these we'll see in the stores or for our usage?
The main issue is upscaling the quantity of produced materials. Always the issue is how much money is put behind commercializing a technology. I believe that certainly within less than 5 years, you'll see commercial applications of this technology, perhaps even sooner. But again, there are no major barriers. When we make our special yarns containing powders by simply taking these webs, these sheets of carbon nanotubes, and painting on top of them the powders, and then twisting the nanotube sheet with overlaid gas into a yarn. It's very simple.
Huh.
The fundamental technology, the twist aspect, has been practiced since prehistoric times.
Wow, it sounds very simple. Well, we're going to watch what happens.
And Thank you very much.
Pay attention to Dr. Bachman, what's going on there. Very interesting stuff. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
It's my great pleasure to talk to you.
You're welcome. Ray Bachman is director of the Nanotech Institute at the University of Texas at Dallas and professor of chemistry there. Interesting stuff with nanotechnology. Stay with us after the break. Something really interesting and useful you can do at home. Maybe you can't make the yarns, but you can do citizen science projects, from gazing at galaxies, solving 3D puzzles, sticking a ruler in the snow, and then tweeting your results. You can be a citizen scientist. We'll tell you how after the break, so stay with us.
It's Friday morning, time again for StoryCorps. Americans are talking about their lives in this project. Rob Littlefield was inspired to share his story by others who've spoken out against bullying in recent months. At StoryCorps, Rob remembered junior high school and what happened when his classmates learned he was gay.
It was like tremendous hate that I had never experienced in my entire life. People called me fag, pointed at me, did pranks on my desk, and it went on the school bus, in the classroom, in my neighborhood. And those kids teamed up and found a way to smash my hand in a car door, and I lost the end of one of my fingers. I lived that year not ever being able to talk to anybody about it. You know, I remember my parents saying, "What's going on? You know, why did this happen?" And at that age, you know, you're scared to death. And the only way that I could see out of that situation was to take my life. I thought about it. I thought about it hard. But my father came home from work one night, and he sat our family down, and he said, "We're moving to Tulsa." Those were the greatest words I ever heard in my life. At 55 years old, I look at this finger still all the time. I can't help but look at that finger. And I could remember the names of those kids when I was 13. I wonder what they think of their gay grandson. Wonder what they think of their gay son. I just wonder how they're living their lives today.
That's Rob Littlefield at StoryCorps in Oklahoma City. His interview will be archived in the StoryCorps collection at the Library of Congress. And by the way, you can get this project's podcast at npr.org.
You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Back in 1969, the early 70s, six Apollo moon missions planted seismometers on that gray lunar surface. The aim, of course, was to measure seismic activity, as we used to call them, moonquakes. And long after the astronauts flew back home, the seismometers were still going, collecting data that were sent back down to Earth through the 1970s. It was some of the first digitized data collection scientists had ever done. Now, the data from some of these seismometers were analyzed, but only in bits and pieces. You see, the computing power needed to sort through it all just wasn't there decades ago. But now, using faster computers and some new techniques for looking at seismic activity, researchers have gone back over the Apollo data, and they've learned more about the moon and its core, and they've published what they've known this week in the journal Science. Joining me now to talk more about it is Renee Weber. She is a planetary scientist at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, so what have you learned about the moon from all this data?
Well, we have learned quite a bit. And what we've just had our paper in Science about was a confirmation of the presence of a core in the moon's deepest interior.
You mean we used to think it was just a big rock, one big piece of boulder or something like that?
Well, no. Various other types of geophysical data have actually been used to infer that the moon had a core, but we have made the first direct seismic observation of the core. Also, that the core itself is layered. There's a solid inner core and a fluid outer core, similar to the Earth.
A fluid outer core? Wow. Does that mean there's like lava under there or something?
Magma, yes.
Magma. And could it pop up someplace? Could we have a volcano on the moon?
Not today. In the past, however, there was some volcanism on the surface of the moon, yes, that created the lunar mare, the seas.
That's quite interesting to know, because I think if people just look at the moon and they think it's just, you know, it turns out to be a lot more complex than most people think.
Yeah, it's not a dead place like people have said in the past. It's not as seismically active as the Earth, but there are different types of seismic energy on the moon. In particular, the deep moonquakes were the ones that we're really interested in analyzing.
Tell us about it. It's fascinating because I remember when they talked about placing these seismometers on the moon. What it was six moon missions to place them around the astronauts, put them there?
Yeah, the first was on Apollo 11. There was the first seismic instrument that had been deployed on a body other than Earth. And that instrument actually only lived for 2 weeks. Then, starting with Apollo 12, there were instruments deployed with every Apollo mission, Apollo 12 and Apollo 14, not Apollo 13, which didn't actually make it to the surface, but then Apollo 15 and Apollo 16. And those seismometers all operated at the same time, forming a network that continually gathered data until 1977.
And so here we are decades later, after all this data has come back. Why such a long period to analyze it?
Well, it hasn't been forgotten that this totally unique data set exists, that the only extraterrestrial seismic data that we have. The first studies that analyzed this data really only looked at small subsets of it, just because the computer capability at the time was not up to par with what we have today. So originally, when we wanted to reanalyze the data, we wanted to look at all of the continuous data rather than just small subsets of it.
And you mentioned that the moon's core is a bit like the Earth's core. How is it unlike the Earth's core?
Well, the relative size of the moon's core is small compared to that of Earth. It's a sort of a smaller percentage of the volume of the moon.
Mm-hmm. Is there still other stuff we can learn from this data?
Yeah, definitely. I have another study that's not related to the paper that we just had come out that's trying to learn more about deep moonquakes and what they are, why they happen. And there are some studies that we can do to try to simulate the scattering of seismic energy that we observe. Hmm. So there's still a lot more, I think, that we can try to look at, try to learn from the Apollo seismic data. In addition, there are some proposed missions to put new seismometers on the moon. And so in order to maximize the scientific return from those instruments, we really want to learn as much as we can from the data we already have.
And the data you get, that comes from observing what happens after a moonquake?
Yes.
And how big, does it have a Richter scale on the moon for a moonquake too?
Well, there have been some comparative estimates made. The different types of seismic activity that we know about are moonquakes, the deep moonquakes, which are occurring about halfway to the center of the moon. So they're really deep. They're not like earthquakes, which occur closer to the surface of the Earth. And those are pretty small. Those are around magnitude 1 or less.
Hmm.
Then there are much larger but much less frequent shallow moonquakes, which maybe max out around magnitude 5. Wow. And those are pretty rare. Maybe only one per year were detected.
Wow. Now, I know that the moon's gravity works on the Earth and gives us the tides here.
Yes.
Now, the Earth's pretty big, massive body. Do we have moon tides without the water?
Yeah, so the gravitational interaction between the moon and the Earth causes tides in the Earth's oceans. But the moon has no oceans, so instead the interaction on the moon is tidal deformation, actual solid body deformation. And it is thought that deformation in part triggers the deep moonquakes. And the reason that we think that is because the deep moonquakes actually occur periodically in line with the tidal periodicities.
You mean the Earth actually causes the moon to bulge like a high tide in some place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a pretty small effect, but yes.
And that may trigger a moonquake.
It's possible. There's a buildup and release of tidal stress within the moon, and that could trigger moonquakes.
Wow, I don't think people think about a moonquake.
It's not like on Earth where the earthquakes are occurring at plate boundaries,
right,
as a result of plate tectonics. The moon doesn't have active plate tectonics like that, so it's a totally different type of seismic energy that we're talking about here.
Can this tell us anything about the origins of the moon? I mean, isn't it generally believed that a planet or some body about the size of Mars hit the Earth in early formation and blew off a piece of debris that became the moon?
Yeah, that's the commonly accepted model. The presence of a core such that we have detected does support the large impact model for lunar formation, especially that there was a liquid part of the core. The moon may have formed in a initially completely molten state.
And then things would have settled into the core by weight and things like that.
Yes, as the moon itself cooled and solidified.
What would you like to know about the moon that you don't know if you could? I'll give you the blank check question. If you had all the money in the world and could do anything with it and create any object or any measuring device for the moon, what would you like to know?
I think it would be really interesting to know whether or not the far side of the moon has any seismicity.
Hmm.
There was a lack of detection of events from the far side of the moon, partially because the instruments were all deployed on the near side of the moon, but also because if you have this hot liquid core in the moon, it's going to attenuate any seismic energy that may have occurred on the far side before it can travel to the stations on the near side. So, you know, given unlimited technological resources, it would be really interesting to try to put seismometers not only on the far side, but all over the moon, globally distributed network of seismometers all over the moon.
Could we do that?
Well, there are a couple of missions proposed that are planning to only deploy a small number of stations. Unfortunately, it's really expensive to do these types of missions, but even a single seismometer deployed in the right place of the right sensitivity could tell us more than what we were able to learn with the Apollo instruments.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question from Tim Beauchamp on the tweet says, how can there be periodic tidal stresses on the moon since it is tidally locked?
The tidal locking means that the moon always shows the same face to the Earth because it rotates at the same rate that it revolves. But the fact is that these periods are not exactly the same, which causes the moon to actually have librations, which are small perturbations of the amount of the lunar surface that is observed from the Earth. Mm-hmm. So you have a periodicity there that is present in the moonquake signature.
It's also incorrect to talk about the far side as the dark side.
That is very true. The entire surface of the moon experiences day and night similarly to Earth, but because the moon revolves so slowly compared to Earth, the day and night are 2 weeks long.
Right. So the far side is getting sunlight. We just never see that.
Correct.
Side of the moon. It's still there, and it's still very fascinating to talk about, and I imagine you're still fascinated by it also.
Yes, definitely.
Is there a reason for your fascination? Have you always been interested in the moon as a scientist?
Yeah, and in space exploration, and anything having to do with planetary bodies and outer space and astronauts and everything like that.
You're sorry we're not on the moon anymore?
I'd love to see more lunar missions in the future.
How about peopled missions?
Yeah. One of the great benefits of having the Apollo seismometers deployed by astronauts was that you're able to get very strong coupling to the ground, which is important when you want to measure the ground motion, which is what a seismometer does.
Are you ready to go and put one there yourself?
I'm not sure about that.
All right. We'll let you off the hook on that one. All right, Dr. Weber, thank you very much for taking time to be with us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
You're welcome. Renee Weber, planetary scientist at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. Ready to have more seismometers on the moon, not ready to go herself to put them there. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about this British Medical Journal study about vaccines. Paul Offit is here. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
The breakdown of a marriage is the subject of the new drama Blue Valentine. It stars Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams as a young couple at the end of their marriage. Through flashbacks, the movie also shows them in earlier, more romantic times. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Gone are the days when filmmakers kept a respectful distance from their characters. In Blue Valentine, writer and director Derek Cianfrance is obsessive in how he uses the handheld camera to get in his actors' faces. Yet there's something in those faces to see, something momentous, angry, desperate, unmanageable. The film is a rough ride with the shock absorbers removed. Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams play a married couple, Dean and Cindy, with a little daughter named Frankie. Dean paints houses and Cindy is a nurse. The movie's opening is as ominous as any horror film. The family dog is missing. Cindy is strangely cold toward Dean and fed up. Something bad is clearly coming. Blue Valentine has a time warp gimmick. Cianfrance cuts back and forth between what might be the end of this marriage and its bumpy but charming beginning. Now, beginnings and endings are relatively simple, the diagram. The true drama is in the unresolved middle zone, when a couple's attraction and repulsion seesaws. Here, there's no seesaw, just the sea and then the saw. But when we look at the beginning of Cindy and Dean's relationship from the vantage of hindsight, we see things we wouldn't otherwise. The very things that are right about them back then are years later wrong. It turns out Dean saved Cindy in a sense. She was stuck in an awful relationship with a local jock and dominated by an abusive father. And Dean was funny and smitten and, more important, eager to take care of her. In one of the film's high points, they duck into the doorway of a closed store, and Dean induces Cindy, with much prodding, to tap dance while he plays guitar and warbles like Tiny Tim. Her surrender is infectious and enchanting. It's only from the perspective of the future that we detect a compulsive, even scary quality in Dean's jokiness. San Fran cuts to years later, when Dean hopes to rekindle the marriage and books the couple into a gimmicky theme motel where they're ensconced in the blue-lit, quote, future room that seems suitable only for android mating. Too much cheap vodka adds to the non-fun. Finally, Cindy comes out with what's been eating her up, that Dean is going nowhere.
Listen, I didn't want to be somebody's husband, okay? And I didn't want to be somebody's dad. That wasn't my goal in life. Some guys it is. It wasn't mine. But somehow, it was what I wanted. I didn't know that. And that's all I want to do. I don't want to do anything else. That's what I want to do. I work so I can do that.
I'd like to see you have a job where you don't have to start drinking at 8 o'clock in the morning to go to it.
No, I have a job that I can drink at 8 o'clock in the morning. What a luxury, you know? I get up from work, I have a beer, I go to work, I paint somebody's house, they're excited about it, I come home, I get to be with you. What's, like, this is the dream.
That's not too promising. And Gosling's Dean becomes increasingly unhinged. He jabbers at her instead of engaging. As she withdraws, he seems on the verge of snapping. Gradually, Dean loses stature, while Cindy, a killjoy in the early scenes, becomes the movie's true protagonist. I frankly found it hard to watch Michelle Williams without thinking about her breakup with Heath Ledger, the father of her child, and the impact of his subsequent death. That's not a problem, though. If anything, it makes her seem more vulnerable. She's always been a raw, see-through actress, and under the camera's tight scrutiny, her emotions seem more seismic than ever, even when her face is still. We sense the strain that comes with Cindy's self-protection. She holds it in and holds it in until she can't anymore. Some critics have found Blue Valentine monotonous, the same note hit again and again. I don't entirely disagree, although I think that its oppressive monotony evokes the dissolution of a marriage shockingly well. There's another major figure on whom to focus, the little girl Frankie. Faith Wilotka is an unusually convincing child actress, and her playful rapport with Gosling's Dean makes you like him despite his demons. The child is the movie's truest casualty, and the one whose future relationships will doubtless be colored by what happens to her parents' marriage. In Blue Valentine, the bad vibes just keep rippling.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. If you summed up the latest jobs report with a single word of slang, that word might be meh. For those who need the numbers behind the expression, here they are. The government says that the economy added a net 103,000 jobs in the month of December. The unemployment rate as a result fell slightly to 9.4%. We're going to get some analysis now from NPR's economics correspondent, John Itzde. John, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
Okay, what does that meh mean in real terms here?
Well, what you've got is a disappointing job creation number, only 103,000 jobs coming from a survey of businesses, and an unemployment rate that dropped sharply to 9.4% from 9.8%. That comes from a separate survey of 60,000 households. Now, most economists look at both of those and view the payroll survey as the best indicator of the health of the job market month to month. And that's what I'm hearing from economists this morning, that the big drop in the unemployment rate is probably a statistical anomaly. They're expecting it to go back up again in the coming months. But the 103,000 job creation number is a disappointment.
Well, let's just make sure that people understand why these numbers sometimes don't match up. The 9.4% is the percentage of people out of work who are looking for work, but that size of the workforce can go up, it can go down, the number of jobs available can go up and go down. And so you sometimes have the numbers heading in different directions. Although we can point out here, John Itzstein, that both numbers seem to have gone at least slightly in the direction you'd wanted to go, just not, you're saying, as far as people had hoped.
Well, both were positive, that's for sure. And one possible reason that the job growth number is so low is that job growth in October and November was actually revised upward by 70,000. So economists were predicting between 150 and 175,000 jobs created this month. They only got 103,000 in December, but there were 70,000 more jobs created in October and November. But I think it is a disappointing number, and I think it's just another reminder that we're not going to see this big breakout in job creation in this recovery. It's going to be a long, hard slog, partly because we have key industries like housing and commercial construction flat on their back. They were big employers, and they're not going to be adding many jobs anytime soon. Also, state and local government budgets are in horrible shape, and they're going to be laying off workers this year. That's also going to be a drag.
And let's remember, in these numbers, private sector employment grew, but actually government employment shrank slightly by about 10,000 jobs. How does all this affect the long-term unemployed, John?
Well, the number of long-term unemployed actually remained about the same. The number of unemployed dropped by 556,000. That's why we got that big drop in the unemployment rate. But again, economists are looking at that number and thinking that it's going to turn around and go back up in the next couple months. So we'll see more unemployed in the household survey in the next couple months and probably a higher rate of unemployment.
All of this comes after Congress and the White House agreed on some major economic changes just at the end of the year, extending President Bush's tax cuts, adding some other tax cuts, extending unemployment. What do people see as the next possible steps given the latest news?
Well, I think that this news suggests that the Federal Reserve, for instance, is going to complete its so-called quantitative easing, which will inject a total of $600 billion into the economy by June, because it just looks like the economy isn't breaking out. We also hear Democrats would like to see more stimulus spending and help for folks facing foreclosure, mm-hmm. That sort of thing. That's not likely to happen now that Republicans control the House of Representatives. The Republicans are calling for cuts in the federal budget, figuring that, you know, if the government gets its finances in order, it will provide a better climate for business. But if those cuts come too soon, it could take demand out of the economy and damage growth, and I'm quite sure the White House would not allow that to happen. So I think not likely to see a lot from the White House and Congress, but the Fed will continue its easing, trying to keep the economy going.
John, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's economics correspondent, John Itzstein. And also, let's mention today that jobs are being cut in the U.S. military. Not right now, though. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says he plans to reduce the size of the Army and Marine Corps by up to 47,000 troops beginning in 2015, that hopefully will be after the largest U.S. obligations in Afghanistan have been met.